So we will continue on with the fundamentals of the Dharma. I think no matter what level of experience we have or we bring to the talk this evening, I think that you can often find something in it that directs or points to your particular practice. I hope so. The fundamentals are not something that are finished early on and then forgotten about. They're really, we have to refresh our acquaintance, our relationship with them for the duration of our practice because they keep meaning something more than what we initially had taken them to mean. And so when we dust these things off, and I'm sort of doing a shotgun approach more or less, not trying to bring the themes into any kind of sequence, but just looking at different themes that really are at the essence of a good soup. If you have a good soup, you have a lot of seasoning, a lot of ingredients in it, especially if it's some kind of vegetable soup. And so any of those ingredients or seasonings that are missing, somehow the flavor just to a good connoisseur of soup would just be a little off, right? So the talk this evening is on the love of honesty. The love of honesty. Just let the phrase sit with you for a second. The love of honesty. Because there's an intangible in practice that I would like to mention in relationship to the love of honesty, and that is sincerity. A sincerity is, you can feel it in someone, but you can't instill it in someone. It's not a gift. They either carry it or they miss it. But you get a sense of someone who has it being drawn in a way that is very clearly heart-centered. That is, they don't have or don't waste a lot of time with distractions. They're interested in the deeper aspects of the practice, and they have an intention that really wants to look and to bear into and uncover those deeper ingredients. And that sense of sincerity, I often, when I do a beginning class, I can often see it in the way someone sits. Looking out, I almost know who's going to continue with this form and who it's just a casual meeting. And so the sincerity is also based in body. It's not just a mental focus, but it's also a way the body moves in relationship to life. And specifically, a love of what is honest, a love of it. That there's a Dharma purification. I avoid such words because it captures the wrong spirit of the Dharma, like I'm getting purified, you know, I'm becoming holy, and all of the misperceptions of where that word takes us. But there is a purification of consciousness. You can't avoid it at some point. That when you allow the sitting to touch your spirit and your body, there's a way that you don't get up from even a single sitting in the same way as you sat down. And there's a kind of love for that feeling, because it's uplifting. It's uplifting in the sense that there's a kind of confidence of being that comes in being able to not be mind driven. But beyond that, there's just a love for the truth, a love for seeing what is true, and a deep resolve not to be distracted from what that truth is showing us. And it's an emotional uplifting, but it's just like, oh, there's just nothing better than this. Nothing. And that sense of benevolence and kindness is part of the radiation of that Dharma purification. And of course, ethics and ethical conduct fall in line. None of this is self-driven. That's the important qualifier, is that we don't set out to be purified in the Dharma by doing, you know, wise things and by not doing bad things or unskillful things, but and to act loving and generous. All of that is superficial to what I'm pointing to. This is a genuine cleansing of consciousness. I just don't know any way of speaking about it. We just ended a week-long retreat out at Cloud Mountain, and you could just feel the effects of that week of silence upon the participants. And it, just the way everybody just rose to silence, and the effects that that silence had upon mind and body, conversation. And you just realize that if we could just get this thing moving sufficiently, it would truly be a revolution of spirit. But so often we get lost in the little really incidental problems of our lives. And I don't mean that they're all incidental. Sometimes they're rather traumatic. But there's always a reframing that we can give any issue. There's always a sense of perspective that the Dharma is able to offer us. Now, I'm going to use words, I'm going to deliberately use two words that are going to, you're going to have to find your definition, follow my definition, but they're going to alter yours. And I do this sometimes deliberately so that you have to readjust the way you look at the perspective you offer something in order to follow mine, because in that readjustment, some old trappings, some old conditioned ways of looking fall away. So I'm going to talk just for a minute about this part of this Dharma purification is that you begin, that there is no where to go. There is just how to go. That's part of the purification of what occurs. There is no where to go. You can see within the where that's the configuration of me. Where I am, where I need to go, the distance I need to travel, the busyness I need to have, and the effort I need to exert in order to get to where directs me. And the prioritizing of the where will undervalue the how. Because the how isn't based upon distance or time or separation at all. The where is always looking for the direction we need to take in order to better the progress towards that direction. But the how is the complete innocence of the moment. When you say how, you have to take everything in. There's a kind of an openness, an innocence of openness, where the moment is affecting us rather than where we're trying to push it or nudge it. And you can see that the where and the how, as I'm defining it in this particular time, are in contradiction to each other. And yet most of us run our meditation practice in accordance with the where. You know, am I doing it right? Are there techniques I'm using? Not very many of us really understand the ingestion of truth. How we let truth in is not through the logistics of our training, not through the techniques that we are applying. There's simply the opening of it, to allow ourselves to be porous, to be open, to let it in, let the truth in, and that's how it affects us. That's the cleansing that occurs. That's the purification. Truth itself purifies. It's not our efforts to purify. And we don't look beyond what it's doing. We don't say, oh, this is really great. What's the next one that's going to happen? That's the where. You see, are you getting a sense of these words a little? And it's to let it affect us. It doesn't, I'm not going to try to, my discernment will show me the facts, and I'll let the facts land where they will and affect consciousness however they will. You see, so there's no defenses. There's nothing, I'm not trying to protect myself from the implication of what is true. I surrender to it without knowing the implications. I simply let my guard down. See, this is required. This is required. All of this is required. Any kind of adaptation or thought or driven, you know, oh, what is this? Well, that's bringing the where into the how. That's forcing the strategies of the way truth is going to affect us. And most of us would like to stand outside, have truth affect consciousness, and we be an innocent bystander to all of that. Sort of, you know, we can catch it on the late movie as to what the effects were, but we don't want to really be a part of those effects. But this really requires more faith in that. Okay, so I'm just bringing in other fundamental that I've talked about, and faith is certainly one. You know, where is the harm? If you've ever let truth affect you, has it ever been, it may have revealed a lot. It may not be an easy truth to ingest. It may require a somber and mature reorganization. But ultimately, it leads us in exactly the direction that our heart wishes to go. So to let this thing, let it in, to receive it, the how of it. And I don't mean, how do I do it? I mean, I don't have any idea. How? That the innocence of the question itself, like how? I have no idea. That's the wonderment. That's the openness. That's the expression of innocence that's necessary for truth to truly bring its force upon us. And so when you allow that to happen, there's a kind of Dharma spirit that you get in, which is part of the purification, that it's not. This is not self-accomplished. You know, this isn't something, I'm not a self-made practitioner. I'm the other extreme. Whatever the other extreme is, I'm not a self-made practitioner. And so what's been doing it all that time? I have no idea. Do you? I don't know. But I know, and this is an important point, I know my practice has to line up with the purity I feel. When I feel the openness and the wonderment, and when I sit in meditation, those two have to line up. Now, mostly, we don't line them up. We distort we may feel it in our life. We may feel joy. We may feel uplift. We may feel spacious. But then our practice may be very contrite, very contrived, very dense, you know, with a lot of heaviness associated with it. And I just like to say, you can use your practice to actually affect the rest of your life positively or negatively, depending upon how you choose and what practice you intend for yourself. But those two should be in alignment, so that as you feel more inclusive and more openness, then the practice you involve yourself in, the formal meditation, should also have that sense of spaciousness and inclusivity within it as well. It should be a natural a natural heritage that the practice claims forth the rest of your life as its stage of openness. And so, you know, if you're, again, I noticed on this retreat, some people hearts were just beaming, but their practice was kind of making them miserable. And the tension within the practice, and how hard they were, all of that, that you go, why don't you just give me your hand here, and just, there, now, how's that feel? I said, how's that feel? You see, that's the Dharma uplift. That's the purification. This whole thing becomes wide open. Without boundaries. And testing the boundaries we do have. And so this Dharma practice we have is also very resolute. It's not a wimpy practice. It's like questioning the assumptions on which that have governed our life, the ways that we hold ourselves and what we have believed about our life and all of the reactions we have to our life and all of the opinions we have about our life. All of these things are brought to bear and looked at and really scrutinized. It's not a smiling, tranquil openness. It's a tranquil openness that has a resolve and a willingness to go wherever it needs to eliminate a boundary, an obscuration, or an opinion. And so I just would like to encourage an infusion of that attitude, of wise attitude, into our practice so that it carries the uplift. And then the practice then affects the day. The day affects the practice, and the practice affects the day. And those two just keep feeding each other. And it should always move towards greater inclusivity. There's nothing in Dharma that's exclusive. You exclude one thing, you have two. There's not two of anything. And it's your job to prove that to be fact. And so if you leave anyone out of your heart because they're unsuitable or they don't meet your approval, fine. Then you've got the multiplicity that we have to deal with on every scale. So just to get a sense of that for ourselves. Now, I'm defining honesty in this talk as our willingness to acknowledge a distortion without pretension, determination to uncover pain without projection, and the ability to face facts without defensiveness. So I'd like to spend time just talking about those three qualities of honesty. But each of those are uplifting in spirit. I don't mean to make any of them into a drudgery, into a labor camp here. They're done not because, well, we have to face the facts. It's because we want to face the fact, because there is a genuine movement of sincerity to live without confinement, without contraction. And so, okay, so let's just look at this acknowledging distortion without pretension. Now, we had a fundamental talk on denial and defensiveness. And may I say, I can think of no other species except ours that can pretend that facts don't exist. We seem to be the only species that can stare right at a fact and give it a different name, if we see it at all. When the Dharma is the observation, an undefended observation. Undefended observation. Why do we need to change anything? Why do we need to defend or distort anything? What is it? See, that's not that we're doing, whether we're doing it or not, but what is it that motivates that to happen? why do I need to distort what's in front of me? What is so important that I can't face the fact? Now that, I mean, we do it all day long, so it's not as if I'm suggesting something that is once a year. But we should have some sense of how this, why we're doing it. I mean, it's if we're not honest, sufficiently honest to be able to look at the motivation for why we're doing it, you can forget this practice. It bases itself within that observation, in that willingness. That's why the uplift, that sense, it reaches a threshold where that's all you want to do, is just see what binds you, see where you're being controlled by the conditioned forces, and where your wakefulness is being distorted, is being ignored. Because this is really an issue of whether we want to remain unconscious or whether we want to be conscious. And those two forces, believe me, are inevitably in conflict with one another. At least unconsciousness is in conflict with consciousness. Consciousness is not in conflict with the unconscious. All consciousness does is hold out its hand. It says, I'm ready when you're ready. When you're willing to show me, I'm ready. And unconscious does a battle with that readiness. You see it, but it can't sustain itself. That's the thing. You knew, I grew up in the 50s, and you knew that the civil rights movement was going to come out, and it was going to be open, and it was going to be successful. Because even at that age, you could see that it was fruitless, unconscious tensions of trying to battle what is truly right and conscious. You just knew that it could sustain itself for a long period of time and continues to have its seeds in our culture. But once it's understood and seen, then the forces that try to keep it bound are doomed to failure, because the forces that keep it bound realize that this have also seen, or they wouldn't be battling it. Right? You don't fight something that you know is true. You fight something when there is the tension of keeping something at bay. So, as long as it takes, and it may take a long time, I'm not suggesting that it's not a prolonged conflict, but you really understand how consciousness also ultimately wins. I mean, for those of you who have seen something in yourself that you wish you had never seen, now go home and try to forget it. You may spend years trying to forget it, and you may actually die and never completely acclimate to it, but you can't forget it anymore. Once seen, always seen. And that's the problem with being conscious, being aware, is that the honesty of the seeing, there's no defense against the honesty of the seeing. So we might as well give ourselves over to this, because even a casual seeing, you're dead. You're already done. All right? So you go, oh, I wish I hadn't seen it. Oh my. And most of us know the parts of ourselves that we wish we had never seen. Right? You know that. Or the parts of your lives that you are delaying showing up for, that you just would like to keep in the closet a few more decades. It's too late. All you're going to do is cause yourself agony. Right? Having that conversation with your spouse that you wish you hadn't realized what was going on, or whatever it is. Whatever it is. So you see, even the slightest glimpse and the battle is all done. I mean, the war may have to be waged, but the outcome is certain. So this ability to abstract an alternative works when you're unconscious. You can pretend yourself away, you can pretend another reality, you can pretend you can have a host of defenses, and you, as long as you remain unconscious and just conditioned reactively and conditioned, then you can be pretty successful at being able to do that. But at some point, you have to, you know, a Dharma student is what's the undefended fact here? What if I stop arguing with what's going on, what does what's going on reveal? And that's when it gets really interesting. Because it really means a complete reorganization of a lot of our life. But always in alignment with the truth of reality. Where we would never, ever ask you, which is even absurd to say, to align yourself to the denial that you've been living. You just wait for the denial to reveal itself to you so that you can figure out how to include it. Sometimes that takes some amount of time in order to do. So some of the ways that we distort reality is, one is that we take what is impermanent to be permanent, because we want it to be permanent, because if things are permanent, it doesn't implicate our bodily impermanence, which means our death. So if we can just hold everything fast to the concept that we give it and never look at the reality of the truth below that concept, that it's actually, then we can kind of live in a pretending world, in a trance of thought that allows life to sustain itself with the thought of permanency. But that doesn't last very long to a Dharma student, because everywhere they look, something's falling away, and it's not long before that dawns on us. And so then when you get drawn in, it just starts drawing you in. Okay, well, if that's not true, how about this? And if that's not true, and it just keeps taking you deeper. Any practice, any spiritual practice with sincerity will start taking you deeper into the truths that practice is meant to show. And then as those truths reveal, it's got you then. It just keeps bringing you more and more into other truths as well. Like taking what cannot possibly satisfy as satisfying. That's a distortion. To think that anything is going to ultimately satisfy. It's just amazing. It's amazing that we believe that, when it's so clear that our life has never, ever given us a single object that forever has been satisfying. In fact, in Faust, Faust called Mephistopheles and said, I'll sign the contract and give you my soul, but before I do so, I want you to give me an experience that will never diminish in pleasure. And of course there isn't one, and so he didn't sign the contract and saved his soul. So saving your soul is as easy as seeing what is true. I mean, you know, we give our lives away to the most insignificant quality. And that would be fine if the external world contained those qualities that we were chasing after. But we're so distorted in how we run after life, we don't really see that we're the ones that are investing and projecting the very thing we're chasing mentally onto that object. There's no object that is more likable than another object or more pleasant, but the mind makes it so. Now, so what do we So when you're just chasing your own mind, and you know that the mind is as whimsical as it is, that there's not a lot of distance between you and the object you're chasing in terms of it falling apart pretty quickly. But just to start feeling that, start sensing that, is an uplift, is a dharma, is a purification, it's a freedom, it's an unburdening. So that you, now you walk with a different, in a different way, not from any pretension or arrogance, but because something has sloughed away, and there's a briskness and an uplift to the walk that you now take, and a confidence. And the heart starts coming out, so it's not like this dry confidence, look at me, everybody else is lost in their ignorance, and me, I'm not. It's not that, it's so you feel more deeply for the pain of others and for your own pain and for the connectedness that's there, and the truth starts bringing us more and more into that uplift, and it just starts compounding upon itself. So the second, first one was acknowledging distortion without pretension. The second is uncovering pain without projecting it out. And those of you who have been in this class for some years know that I have a very strong admonition to be radically accountable for our emotions in particular, because we believe the world to carry our emotional justifications. If something goes wrong, it's your fault. This knee-jerk sense of blame is all a distortion of truth. And it's not until we can hold our emotional life as our own without thinking that circumstances have contrived to make me angry and I'd be far better off if you weren't in my life, and all of the internal reactions that we have are other caused, when simply they are conditions, they arise from conditions. Internal set of conditions, an external set of conditions, and an emotion arises in a particular way. It's not our fault, it's not our blame, it's not another person's fault, it's not another person's blame. But until we can hermetically seal off the need to accuse others for the emotions we have, road rage, or whatever it might, however it might manifest, then we will forever live in this kind of turbulent, distorted world of the dishonest. Just be able to, okay, so there are multiple factors here. Your narrative, our narrative, is always one-sided. No matter what you're saying to yourself, it's your opinions that are forming your narrative. And to base your actions upon your opinions and upon your side without a sense of what the totality is going to clearly be a very limited and often self-serving action. So that sense of uncovering pain without projecting it out, just being able to feel and own one's life. And not, you know, say, well, so what caused this anger? It's the butterfly in Argentina. That's what did it. I mean, it's everything causes everything else. Limitless, infinite is any single cause. Because it's everything. Who are you going to blame? So the third definition of honesty was facing facts without defensiveness. Now, you know, that's not easy to do if you, on your annual evaluation, hearing your boss, you know, and the feedback you receive, and you go, oh. And how quickly, you know, say, well, he didn't see me. I mean, he doesn't really know me. I mean, I don't, yeah. And all the ways that we try to rationalize what is being seen in us. And the feedback and And, oh, you know, just the following the line of truth. Okay, is there something here that I need to listen to? And what I used to do, sometimes I'd get a rather reactive letter in the mail, or when they had mail. And what I'd do is just fold it up, put it back in my drawer, and I would wait for a different time when I could read that thing. And then I'd bring it out, dust it off, bring it out. I'll say, is there anything here that I need to learn? I'd read it, and then I would get a sense of what was being said and whether there was something that, some correction that needed to be made. So, you know, it's not to weigh in that every point of feedback is always accurate, but it's the willingness to look and see and go, okay, so they may have a point here. I can see that tendency in me. When you live with a lot of self-doubt, which we all do, we have a tendency to believe, first of all, you react to the feedback because you believe it's true. That's where all reactions come from, is to offset the truth. You react to it. But the feedback may not be true. But we have such self-doubt that we're more likely to believe the feedback than to believe our own sense of conduct or our own assessment of our conduct. And that can be as troublesome as the reaction. And so you just, wait a second here, let me look at this really deeply here. Was that misinterpreted? Was that misunderstood? Whatever. But it's the willingness to look and see. You know, I was a social worker in a hospice program for a number of years. And one case I attended, there were like five children and both parents. The wife was dying, and all seven people in the house were social workers. And you think, you're a social worker, I'm a social worker. So I think, okay, well, this should be fun. You know, you go, it was the most miserable case I ever had. Everybody was trying to bare their soul, and they weren't supporting. It was like this whole kind of, it was all sort of, it wasn't clear, it was just all kind of gelled together and people processing. Meanwhile, the patient was not being tended to. Okay, so come on, you know, clear this up a little bit. Clean up here. You know, let's just, okay, so you can, don't bring your job into your family. So, you know, and so we all have a preset way of looking at ourselves, usually much more positive than other people might look at us. And so you don't want to live in that fantasy realm. You want to see what you actually are. You know, so you look for opportunities for that. Not easy, but you look for them. Now, let me deviate for a moment and say that the more I'm in control, the more of me I try to assert, the less truth will come forth. And that's part of my opinions and reactions are really to offset the truth of what I see. My entrenched defensiveness. But just the manifestation of self itself is an embodiment of the ignorance we're trying to dispel. The sense of self is formed from ignorance. Because if you saw what was true, you would see right through yourself like a hologram. But because we don't, we know there's some way that consciousness is not seen clearly, or we wouldn't be claiming reference to me. And so as we start learning how to become more transparent and open to the honesty that's in front of us and invite truth in, facts start taking us, they don't just take us to the relative truth of what that fact means about us, they take us through ourselves. They begin to show the very transparency of the self itself. And any fact, any experienced fact, can show us, if we're willing, the emptiness of all things. But what we usually do is that we're so afraid, I mean, we think we're afraid of the fact and what it will reveal to us in a relative nature. That's nothing compared to what that fact will reveal about the entire state of the universe if it's pursued to its end point. What we do with facts is that we move with them mentally. We fabricate. We look about them. So that's it. Now let me move on. That movement is what needs to cease in order for the fact to show us the interconnectedness of all things. So, in our meditation, when something arises and it has a self-description, like an emotion, and a content that bears forth, and a narrative around that content, to be quiet, to see that the narrative does not explain the fact. It defines the fact. It doesn't get to the origin of that fact. The origin of the fact must be seen when the mind is quiet. And when the mind is quiet, the fact then reveals itself as something other than what we believed it to be. Then the sun really does shine. And then the empowered sense of where this thing is taking us and the certainty of what we're doing is beyond question. And then we start ending pretension. We start ending the need to pretend, the need to create an abstraction, to live in the veil of what we believe life to be. Look around the room. Is there anything you don't know in the room? It's because we all live within the veil of what we have defined everything to be. Where's the wonderment? Where's the innocence? Where's the how? That's the where. The abstract will provide the where, it'll provide the details, it'll show you exactly where you are and what you need to do to get through all of this to find the products of your choice. That's the where. But it will not show us the how. It will not show us the innocence, the openness, the inclusivity. That is the Dharma uplift, which is the honesty arising, which is the true meaning of life. The true uplift of life. To that I wish you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? Stillness is your home. Noise is what you've built on top of your home. Go to your home. Go to where you truly belong. You won't find it, you'll never find it in the story you provide for yourself. That story will continually be provoked, upset, contested. Okay. If there's any questions or comments, I'd be happy to entertain. Yes, sir.
As I understand, your reactivity as a favorite denial of truth. If one is, if there is no doubt, and you're facing something that you know is wrong, and you're confident in your doubt, I mean, you're confident in the truth about matter, then there's no reactivity.
There's a response. The question is, is reactivity, when reactivity is seen, the fact that reactivity is happening is the denial of the truth, is the denial of actually seeing. It's an emotional, conditioned way that we see something. It's not the truth of what we see. So when you see something that is true, would there be reactivity? Well, you can see something that is true, and there can be the conditioned reflex that's from the past that you can feel very strongly is still a part of your psyche. But when you're seeing what is true and that reflex occurs, the reflex is held within the greater environment of what is true. In the greater sense of the here and now, that reflective action might arise, but it doesn't confiscate the whole story. Because once the truth is being held, then and the reaction is the old defense pattern, which tries to have you look away or to bring your own opinion upon what is being seen or whatever it is, then that is being held by something much more vast, much more inclusive than that small reactive pattern. And so the reactive pattern arises within it, but it can't create the same domino effect that it always has done. So it's interesting to start watching how reactive patterns start losing their hold on us over time. For a long time, our need to see the way we've always believed is stronger than our need to see the truth. And so then our reactions still sort of drag us through the briar patch. Eventually, our need to see the truth is stronger than our need to perpetuate ourselves within the reactive pattern, and then the whole thing switches. Right? I say, okay. Sometimes it's very interesting because I'll see myself reacting from some kind of old pattern, and as I'm doing it, I'm saying, I don't need to do this anymore. I actually see, the end has come, and yet for some reason, it's like a lion that has one more growl left in it before it dies, you know? And a growl, and so you go, and you just think, this is ridiculous. Even while you seem to be playing out the old pattern. So that's an interesting one. Be patient. All of this comes through your sincerity. All of it passes through the door of your sincerity. If you don't want it to happen, don't worry, it won't. Well, what do you think has kept us ignorant for all this time? Because we don't want to see. That's what's kept it. The Buddha says the deliberate act of not seeing. No one's doing this to us except us. Those are really strong words. And so when we have no longer a wish, you know, to, like a child, make it all go away, then we'll see. And then it starts. It usually starts with the easier things until we get used to it, used to how this thing works. Impermanence, okay, that doesn't shake my world too much. I don't have to worry about my new car getting scratched. It's already scratched in the impermanence of things. So I can let go of that. I start seeing that. That's good. But don't ask me to give up what is satisfying or to start questioning what is satisfying, because nobody's asking us to give up anything until we have sufficient insight to see that it's not worth pursuing. But don't ask me to do that, because I have my activities that I love to indulge in. Okay, so nobody's asking anything, and just the sincerity of heart says, well, okay, I've been indulging in this for a long period of time. Let me see if it's as satisfying as I portray it to be. What's good, it's nice. Sitting there in your bathtub, temperature exactly right for the water, you have a glass of wine, you're listening to some opera, I don't know. And you go, and then your hands start getting prune-like. Right? There's always something. There's always something. Even in the most wealthy, you can't buy it. You can't buy its perpetuation. Yes.
Some of what you said has to do with not being able to find stable conditions for lasting happiness. And the way that I would like to work it is to see if there is maybe a spiritual roundabout to be able to get that permanent happiness. And I don't know if it's a paradigm problem or what, if that is achievable, or if I should expect to always be beat up by life and just kind of find a way to be good with it.
So the question is whether life is ever going to show us something that is truly and ultimately and continuously satisfying, or is that a fault? Find that out. Don't go another year believing that. All right. So what experience? I mean, you start retrospectively and say, what experience have I ever had? Because it would still be happening if it was continuous and everlasting, wouldn't it? What experience that I ever had follows me to this moment as everlastingly satisfying? Because it was all situational. It was all conditional. I had a great bath, but it. Then the water got cold. You know, I had a great husband, but, you know, whatever. It's always like that, right? Like, you get a spouse, and you meet, and you're both at peaks, you know, but peaks and troughs. So you have peaks and troughs that are trying to have a relationship. You know, you're up, he's down, he's up, you're down. You might meet every once in a while. Oh, this is perfect! Doesn't work. So, I mean, really look and see. I mean, just say, okay, this is an experience I think is great. Now let's see. Don't blame yourself that says, well, I couldn't perpetuate it. You see, that's playing God and saying that if you had used all your power, you could sustain this thing. Nope. It's only briefly sustained. Very briefly. So that's it. Now how many experiences do I have to prove the theory? Right? I don't have to go through every one of them. Right? I can look at other people and see how miserable they are and say, well, they've lived their share and, you know, what are we, say 150 or so, 200 in this room strong. Okay, average age is 50. Whatever, 50, let's say it's 1,000 years, or 10,000 years, something like that, something like that, 10,000 years of human experience. How many of you have found a permanent experience that you just... I always want one person to raise their hand so I can ask him, please tell me what that was. Was it water waves? Anyway, well, where's the beautiful sky at night, dear?
At night?
Yeah, at night. You know, it was beautiful. It's in transition. That's the beautiful sky. And sometimes you don't care how beautiful it is because you're miserable inside. And so it also depends upon your ability to see beauty, which is pretty rare. So don't establish an external fact as being what you... Look at the relationship to yourself with each thing. That is the truth of life. Not that there's a rose. These things are look at that. I'll have a picture of that, and every time I see it, it will be the most beautiful thing. Well, that's a picture. You leave this alone, and it's going to die. Or am I telling you something you don't know? Right? It's going to wilt. Right? And so how many of us have captured the beauty on a photograph, and then we get bored of the photograph? Right? Doesn't hold the inspiration anymore. See, that's it. It's not that, oh, well, if I just bring back the inspiration, it'll be as beautiful as it ever. No, it's a relationship. The relationship can't be sustained. This isn't a one-sided trip. You see? It's the external perfection. When the internal is, no, it will never be that. It's always how the internal meets the external. Okay, Elmer. Thank you.